Hi, I'm Jim Stern. You'll hear the eMetrics Summit mentioned multiple times in this episode, so the guys asked me to just plug it outright at the beginning. So here's what you need to know. The eMetrics Summit brings together the best and the brightest and the most willing to share what they know about online marketing analytics. Learn about how to optimize awareness and persuasion and retention. You're going to learn from practitioners and consultants and vendors. And it's going to be in San Francisco in April, Chicago in June, New York and London in October, and Berlin in November. It's the eMetrics Summit. It is the birthplace of the Digital Analytics Association, and you can find it at emetrics.org.
Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. Three analytics pros and the occasional guest discussing digital analytics issues of the day. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/analytics hour. And now, the Digital Analytics Power Hour.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Digital Analytics Power Hour. This is episode 29. You know, every nation has founding fathers. And Digital Analytics Nation, that's a term I just made up, is no exception. Who are these brave men and women from our past, and how can we find out more about the short but rich history of this most amazing of disciplines? It sounds like a job for our guest tonight, Jim Stern. You probably know him best from his cameo appearance in episode 26, but actually, Jim has led the charge for digital analytics and digital marketing for almost 25 years. He started the most recognizable digital analytics conference, eMetrics. He co-founded the Digital Analytics Association and has written three books on the topic of digital analytics. And he got Chris Deciden to start drinking scotch. So sit down, pour a drink as smooth as his voice, and relax. This episode of the Digital Analytics Power Hour is about the history of digital analytics with none other than the Godfather himself. Welcome, Jim.
I'm a little overwhelmed and a bit verklempt. Thank you so much for that introduction.
Speaking of overwhelmed and verklempt, let me also bring in our other two co-hosts. Tim Wilson, senior partner at Analytics Demystified.
I am keeping a running list of vocabulary words I need to Google during this episode.
And, of course, our neighbor to the north, Jim Kane, CEO of Napkin and Babbage Systems.
Hello.
And most of you know that I am Michael Helbling, and I lead analytics at a small company in Georgia called Search Discovery.
I had to go to the first dictionary I looked in did not have a definition for verklempt because that was the Devil's Data Dictionary, but I did find it on the interwebs. So I'm all caught up now. Carry on.
So I think most people would want to start off right away, Jim Stern, with the question, what were you thinking when you invented web analytics?
So here's where the name Godfather really comes in handy, because I was not there at the conception. I had nothing to do with the birth, but I am devoted to making sure that this industry grows up and lives a long, healthy life. So Godfather is pretty appropriate. Just like the internet, this is something I tripped over rather than had anything to do with inventing.
This does kind of make me feel like we should have a dramatic reading from the Devil's Data Dictionary for the definition of algorithm. Could you deliver that from your book?
A selection.
Are you kidding? I travel with a book in hand constantly. An algorithm is defined as regularly recurring remarks from the former U.S. vice president who invented the internet.
See how I brought that together? I'm feeling like I studied up for our guest.
This is also one definition in the book that anybody over 40 years old gets, even though they don't get any of the others. My dad liked that one, and he's 89.
Well, since we're kind of regularly anti-millennial, it's okay if the other people who are under 40 don't get it, right?
If somebody comes along who gets all of the definitions and understands all the jokes, it will freak me out.
Did I tell you that actually my mother was in town and I made a comment and said, oh, you've heard me talk about this guy. He wrote this book. And because she's an English major, so she certainly gets the Ambrose Bierce reference. However, I had to leave the room after about the fourth grilling she was trying to give me to explain the humor or explain one of the definitions, because she not only had like never heard of the word, and then the any of the jokes behind it. I was like, I'm so sorry that this was a poor choice on my part.
Tim, I am so sorry. I apologize for putting a rift between you and your mother. But for your listeners' benefit, I would like to introduce Ambrose Bierce to those who do not know who he is. This is the guy who wrote the Devil's Dictionary in 1906, and it is full of stuff. It's a big book, and it contains really choice gems, including bore, a person who talks when you wish him to listen, love, a temporary insanity curable by marriage, politeness, the most acceptable hypocrisy, and success, the one unpardonable sin against one's fellows. I take no credit for those, but I am inspired.
Did he have a definition for web analytics? Or did that predate the history just a little bit, 1906?
I didn't get that far in the book.
So when exactly did I should know this. What do we date the start of web analytics to?
1995.
And that was Logfile?
93 was the browser, was Mosaic. And by 95, we had commercial available stuff and open source, although they didn't know to call it that. So there was Sawmill to do log file analysis. Web Trends came along in 1995. NetGenesis came along in 1995. Mm-hmm. And that's where it began.
Analog, I think, came out that year.
Turner. Fun fact, my cousin was part of the original Mosaic team.
That is fun. Wow.
Fun fact, web analytics is 10 years younger than Back to the Future.
I thought we'd move beyond Back to the Future.
At least we're older than Facebook, so that's all that matters.
I was standing on my toilet trying to hang a clock, and I fell and hit my head. And that's when I came up with the idea for the web trends. That was a Doc Brown reference.
Well done.
Thank you.
Yep. So there is a really interesting thing to talk about really briefly, and it gets onto a couple of different tangents, but we'll see where it takes us. Web analytics did come from, first and foremost, the log files coming out of websites, and people started looking at those. And so that was primarily a technical activity. And so the first tools were being used by technologists and IT organizations. And when did people start to really make that corner of, hey, we could use this in the context of our business, right? Because that's certainly where we are today. But like, let's talk about that. And what were some of those first uses that, you know, you've seen Jim Stern and others?
Well, so that would be 2002, because that's when the first eMetrics Summit was, 15 years ago. There was a shouting argument in 2002 at eMetrics in Santa Barbara between two guys wearing Birkenstock sandals and ponytails about whether log file analysis or JavaScript was better.
Oh, and do tell, who was on which side?
Or Rufus Evans was one of the technical founders of a company called Clickstream in the UK that did packet sniffing. And the other ponytail wearer was Eric Peterson. And they got into a heated argument that extended all the way into the lobby bar, hence the beginning of the lobby bar. And the result was they ended up agreeing completely that both of them were necessary.
So we're just the inheritors of the ponytail bar debate.
That's right.
But it does seem like that transition, and I count myself back to about 2001 when I inherited a NetGenesis implementation. And so in a sense, I count myself lucky in that between migrating from NetGenesis to WebTrends, I got a deep technical education on what goes into a log file and what's in the HTTP header and what can be recorded. But there's part of me that while the data was always messy, like with the NetGenesis stuff, it took forever to run because we were basically once a month cranking out a ton of reports that took increasingly long to crank out. And then there were these static reports. And then they put MicroStrategy on front of it and said, oh, now you can slice and dice. And you really couldn't, not in an effective way. So we were battling. And on the one hand, I feel like back then I was battling the, shoot, I don't have that data, or I don't trust that data, or Gomez was doing a sales pitch and they pinged this page and they fucked up the data. So fighting kind of data quality ever since then. But on the flip side, I feel like the old guy who says, yeah, but when it was just when digital was really just our site and we were just discovering AdWords as a way to drive, you know, pay to drive traffic to the site, things did seem simpler. Although I'd say it was still incredibly guilty of, you know, just counting visits and page views. I feel like the data has gotten more complex and we haven't kept up with getting the data consistently clean. Like that's a never ending battle. But the behavior of the consumer and the number of digital channels that all fall under when we, you know, transition from website analysis to digital analytics, that feels like just such a much more involved and complex scope. And I don't know that there was, I kind of lived through that transition and was oblivious to it through the entire change. Stuff just kept getting more complicated.
I remember when the WAA changed its name to the DAA and I was like, come on, guys, you're just trying to get cute. And then I started to think about it more and more and it was like, that's a good step towards not marginalizing the web analyst.
Yeah, it's almost like we had a brief period there, what it must have felt like for advertisers when there was only three television stations. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like we just have our website to measure. That's all we've got to worry about.
And when the WAA started, the first meeting of what would become the board of directors was, what do we call this thing? And I was adamant that it should be customer analytics. And I was shouted down because, no, we want to draw attention to the fact that this is a new data set that nobody's ever seen before. It's the website, it's web data, it's behavioral data, it's stuff you've never been able to analyze before. It's not CRM, it's not database management systems and doing direct mail analysis. This is unique. So it's the Web Analytics Association. So I lost that battle. Then 6 years later, the board had the discussion again. Shouldn't we change our name? Because web data is such a narrow thing and we're measuring email and search and campaigns and social media. And oh, by the way, when they run an ad on TV, they ask us to measure the impact that it's having on Twitter. So clearly we're beyond web analytics. We should be the Digital Analytics Association. And I was adamant that we really needed to be the customer data analytics kind of, you know, the customer relationship with the company online, the digital experience. No, that's too narrow. We might want to take over the world someday. So that's twice that I've lost in the battle of what we should call this thing.
It surprised me as I've run into it, the more companies that I work with, that when we talk about customer analytics, and I know that I absolutely get the need to be truly customer centric, and there's been some great writing on what does customer centric even mean. But regularly run into organizations that have, you know, customer analytics lives in the BI organization, and they are the ones who are cranking through the customer data warehouse, the CRM, wherever the customer data lives. And it's not even occurring to anyone that world should be blending and merging with the traditional web analytics world. The funny thing is, when I got into web analytics, I was very quickly in an organization where all of that was in one BI department. And we didn't know any better. It just seemed like that was all the data. We should have our data warehouse, our customer data, our ERP, all that should be kind of in one, our market research should be in one centralized group. But we know we're talking about the history. Maybe this is more of the future. And I don't know what you guys see as well. I certainly still seem to run into places where they say, we have no digital analytics. Oh, yeah, we've got a whole customer analytics team. We got 20 customer analysts. And it's not, the light bulb's not going on that, hey, maybe that group should also be the experts on the digital data.
I have maintained my sanity by dividing all of this up into four really clear areas. BI has traditionally been about internal business processes. Let's manage shop floor control. Let's manage supply chain. Let's manage efficiency of our employees. Then we've got customer analysis, which has been the mailing database, the direct mail database, which then sort of became customer relationship management and Salesforce automation. And then there was market research. Let's go out and interview and survey a gazillion people and produce reports that are general across the whole thing. And then came along this weird little thing that was behavioral data. Nobody had ever seen mouse clicks before. Determining intent based on what you type into a search engine. This was so unique and so new. BI people didn't know what to do with it. CRM people said, it won't fit in my database. I can't handle time series data that flows that big. So a unique group, a unique industry was created, digital analytics. How do we measure the ongoing touchpoint relationship between customer and company so that we can make mobile better, we can make the website better, we can measure whether or not our campaigns are working and whether or not our search keywords are correct. And this is so different from the structured data mainframe mindset that it had to be a unique, different group of people.
This is funny because, I mean, I told this little story before. The way I got into what was a BI role, although it probably fit more under the customer analytics definition, was almost exactly market research lived in the advertising. Web mm-hmm. analytics lived in Marcom. It had kind of moved mm-hmm. with me through a couple yep. of things from our community to Marcom. BI, what we called BI, maybe was more customer analysis, although we sort of touched all sorts of stuff. And I was having to, logically, it just made sense to several of us to move the behavioral, the web analytics, into the BI, or in this case, the customer analysis group. And after having that conversation of saying, hey, does this make sense? And they said, sure, you know, if you'll help kind of hold our hands and help us understand what the data is, we'd love to get our hands on that data. It totally makes sense to bring this behavioral stuff together with the customer stuff. And then as I was leaving that meeting, I said, well, this kind of sucks because this is like the one part of my job. I was a Marcom manager, basically a web Marcom manager. This is the most fun I have with my job. It just doesn't fit. I don't have the bandwidth for it. And they said, oh, let's keep talking. So I wound up going with it. And it was inside of a year after that that we said, why is the market research department off in a totally different group? And they were kind of orphaned in the group they were in. So it wasn't like we were doing any sort of a land grab. It was just a little two-person department. And we found ourselves talking to them all the time mm-hmm. and said, hey, wouldn't it make sense for you guys to be with us as well? And I continue to be amazed that, and this is, it sounds almost like a humble brag. I mean, we literally were just oblivious. It made so much logical sense. And now with as many companies as I've seen how they're organized, one, the ones that don't have a behavioral digital analytics staff, or they don't have market research, or they don't have any of those groups, or when they do, there's not a clear direction that these groups should come together. And maybe just a little bit with what Gary Angel talked about on our last episode, that's just kind of organizational evolution, that we just kind of gravitate to silos. And that seems like for something that's now been around since 1995, that we should, you'd think that light bulb would have gone on by now.
Yeah, but the light bulb's gone off before for people, or gone on rather. It's to go back to Jim's statements earlier about why was it the DAA or why was it the WAA? If you call it web analytics or digital analytics, you're building a very valuable house, but you're building it on land nobody else wanted. There are, at the enterprise level, pre-existing teams of people that do customer analytics. Then just like you said in that role, Tim, there was a team of people who do behavioral analytics, and they happen to get along with you. But if you go and you rename the DAA, the Customer Analytics Association, you're shooting a flare in the air. You're trying to eat someone's lunch. That what? Becomes a thing.
What is that? Is the DMA, would they say that they are the Customer Analytics Association now?
I understand that the DMA started out as the Direct Mail Association. Then they changed to Direct Marketing. Now they want to change to Digital Marketing. It's humorous.
Oh, they're just fortunate with their first letters of their evolution.
Well, and I'm not lobbying for keeping any name what it is. I actually think it's important that if web analysts don't start to say, actually, I influence or direct key pieces of the business that aren't just web analytics data, we're going to be marginalized to the point where someone eats our lunch. And then the next thing you know, we all have to show up to a bullshit IAB meeting.
Well, I mean, it's so interesting that these silos happen in organizations, but then as you get good, you break these silos back down again. And I wonder if, let's say the silos didn't exist, would we master this data set, or would we still be approaching it kind of the wrong way and doing it in the ways that the other groups would try to do it?
I'm going to throw an orange flag on the field. This is where I have a problem with data democratization, and that is the only way you can put all the data together in one place and have it work is if you sprinkle machine learning on top of it, because every data set requires a subject matter expert. And if you're an expert in market research and doing surveys, if you're an expert in television ratings, if you're an expert in Salesforce automation tools, each of those are really unique realms. And you can't just throw all the data together and expect it to make sense to an individual. So I don't think that if there were one place in the company where all the data feeds came, that it would magically have value. I think every data stream needs a steward who really understands the deep darkness of how trustworthy the data is, how reliable it is, how fresh it is.
We use the word curator a lot when we're talking about that. So, good one. Yeah, totally agree.
I agree with that as well. I think maybe the non sequitur for me there was the necessity for machine learning, but maybe I just didn't understand that. Do you want to expand on that a little bit?
So the thing that machine learning is really good at is finding correlations. So there is a correlation between the sales of ice cream and the number of people who drown in a month. And for the machine to go, oh, look, there's a correlation, is useful to the human. The human can look at that and say, well, of course, because the temperature goes up, more ice cream is sold and more people go swimming, but there's no causality here. So thank you, but no thank you. And then the machine says, hey, there's a correlation between when it rains and people buy umbrellas. And the human says, thank you, Captain Obvious. That's true, but it's not useful. Try again. And the machine says, you know, when this particular kind of person who exhibits this particular kind of behavior, who came to us from this particular source and responded to that particular email, is 37% more likely to purchase if we send him a message that has this benefit statement, I say thank you.
So that,
yeah, I'm with all of that.
Well, but I'm skeptical to one further degree on that, because there's still a need to have variation in activity. I think that's the other place where things start to fall down.
Help me out. What does that mean?
Well, so, or let me give a very, very simple example is social media. Facebook. Back in the, what's the best time for us to post on Facebook? And this is kind of a gross, simplified example of where if the machine isn't fed, it can't do anything with it. Mm-hmm. That when it's like, well, we want to know what the best time of day to post on Facebook is. So you say, well, okay, we're going to look at all the posts you've done for the last 6 months. Well, it turns out that you've only posted between 8 and 10 a.m. every single Facebook post, because that's the process that the agency or the company set up, that somebody thought this is the best time to post, and so that's when they post. So you can't find a correlation between, oh, if we post after 10 p.m., we get higher engagement, because there's no data there. So if you take to your example of if we send this type of email, well, that means I have to be sending a range of types of emails to a range of types of people. And all too often, we get in the, what's the simplest path? What's the one email we're going to send at the one time? Maybe we'll do some subject line testing, but we're going to be in this rhythm. And we say, we've got all this data. It's like, yes, you have all this data, but it's all largely the same because you haven't tried anything different. So you need to kind of back up and have a little bit of a design of experiments approach and saying, well, how do we want to mix things up so that we're generating some data so the machine has something to play with?
And this is why Skynet will never eat your lunch and take your job. Because Skynet's really good at stuff, but it's really dumb at other stuff. You know, computers are really fast, but really dumb. And humans are really smart, but really slow. And you got to put them both together.
Well, next time I'm eating some ice cream by a pool and a robot slaps it out of my hand, I'll know what happened.
It just saved your life.
It just saved your life.
Wow. So that took a...
Anyways.
We went down. All right.
Where
there.
Were we?
So, question for me. You've met a lot of companies that do measurement. I'm sure a lot of them have brought you in. And everybody on this call today is making money off companies that know what winning looks like in measurement, but they need someone to help them do it. And they're all missing different pieces of that equation. Can you give an example of a company where you walked in and you were preparing? Because, you know, like, it's not your first rodeo. I'm sure when you go into a company, you go, when I ask this question, they will say no, and I will help them fix it. Like, you know the dance mm-hmm. steps.
Yep.
Can you kind of share an anecdote about an organization you walked into where you were like, whoa, shit, that you don't need me. Let me write this down.
Yeah, there were two of those. The first one was Hewlett Packard. So when I wrote customer service on the internet in 1997, I interviewed a guy at Compaq Computer, and he was getting it. I mean, he just totally had it wired. But I was talking to them the day that it was announced that Hewlett Packard was going to hire them. So a year later, he calls me up and says, hey, we need a workshop at Hewlett Packard because the Compaq Computer team became the head of all analytics for HP, and I'm running it, and we need your help. And I went, yeah, right. So I go to HP. We spend the first half of the day where they're telling me what they're doing, and I am just blown away. They are doing conversion analysis and source analysis and how is my dollar being spent and where is it being wasted perfectly. It's just beautiful. I'm ready to write another book. And we go out to lunch, and I turn to Seth Romano, one of the founding board members of the WAA and head of analytics for HP, and I say, Seth, I'm beyond. You guys are just like totally in the groove. I can't. There's nothing I can do for you. He says, nah, it's fine. You'll be fine. I said, no, really, I can't. I cannot send you an invoice. I shouldn't even be here. You guys are awesome. I'm writing another book about you. He said, well, just, you know, come on back and like, let's reconvene and we'll talk some more. And I got nothing. So I pull out of the bottom of my bag the last question that proves to the audience that I have no idea what I'm talking about. It is the consultant's last-ditch effort. I say, so guys, tell me, what's the hard part? And it was like they picked up the garbage can and dumped it on the table. Well, this doesn't work, and this technology is broken, and this executive won't give us budget, and these people don't believe what we're saying, and these people won't do this. And it was like, oh, guys, settle down. Yes, I can help you. The second time was in Boston at the last eMetric Summit. I went out to dinner with Jun Lee and Stefan Hamal and Josh Aberrant, who is the postmaster at Twitter, who had given a keynote speech in Boston. And we said, so, you know, here are all the problems that we're all experiencing with our clients. And, you know, they've got data silos and we've got legacy systems and we've got people who don't get it and we're trying to convince upper management and we're trying to get more budget. And he's looking at us like we're from Mars. He says, I'm sorry, I cannot relate. At Twitter, we have one data set and we have one goal and we all work off the same data and we all believe in data. And a year ago, the CEO got up at a company all hands meeting and said, if anybody wants to run a 1% test, they don't need permission. They just go ahead and run the test. And we all went, woohoo, we can just like hypothesize out the wazoo and test everything we want. And then we realized that if you ran a 1% test on Twitter and it didn't work, you just pissed off 6 million people for a whole day. Your job is in trouble. So be careful what you're testing. And then they ran all these tests and they would go, wow, look, we found this and we found this and we found this. And then they discovered that they were up against the wall of, I found this really cool correlation. And the first question was always, well, really, what experiments did you run? What does it mean? So June and Stefan and I are looking at this guy going, well, this is Nirvana. This is a giant corporation that has one data set. There's one source of truth. They believe in data. They love testing. They're doing it right. And it's still really hard.
And then Josh left 2 months later and went to SparkPost, right?
He went to SparkPost, where he has been doing some further research and then doing research about what Google and Microsoft are up to. And he will be keynoting again in San Francisco at the eMetrics Summit in April. So we'll get a bigger story.
It sounds like in both cases, you walked in and there was a good story, or there was a story of we've got it all figured out, but it sounds like as you probed farther, there really wasn't really nirvana.
There is no end game. There is not a solution to this problem. It is data which is messy and difficult to understand and requires a curator for each data set. And there is politics and there is legacy. And there are people who are not very bright, who have too much control over the process in every company at every level.
I like how the two companies, like one of them was an old school enterprise that had a winning team, but kind of organizational entropy. And the other one had organization at the speed of light and people were just getting like ice cream headaches. You know what I mean? Like
exactly.
Opposite problems on both sides.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to turn our attention toward the venerable Hippo for a minute, because they entered our digital analytics world and caused a lot of turmoil, and yet the three of us find ourselves defending them quite often. When did that really start entering the lingua franca, if you will, of the analytics community? I'm not sure of the timing.
As soon as it became about money, understand the culture of this stuff goes way back. 1993 is when Mosaic came out. And the only people that had websites were called webmasters. It was Dilbert in the bowels of the IT department. And he built a website out of a server that he downloaded somewhere, put it on an old 386 machine under his desk and hooked it up to an ISDN line. And eventually, somebody in the company realized that they had a website and that the brand was being represented by Dilbert. And the marketing department took it over and said, well, Dilbert, we're going to now name you Webmaster. And Dilbert had never been in marketing, and marketing had never seen technology before. And it was a mashup of people who had never talked to each other before. And the webmaster was responsible for all of the creative and display because people said, we want this picture. So like, well, I can put up a PDF, but if you want something with buttons, I've got to do all this stuff. Same thing happened with analytics. It was the webmaster who discovered there were log files. And so he said, oh, there's, you know, look at all this data. There's got to be a pony in here somewhere, without any clue that there was a BI department, without any clue. He had never had statistics classes. He's just looking at these static reports from NetGenesis and going, wow, I got money for this product and now I'm getting these reports and I don't know what they mean. And that's the way it has always been, until eventually the website was actually making enough money that somebody upstairs said, oh, this is important. It shouldn't just be something we're doing for fun. We should invest in this. And therefore, we should manage it and control it. And my wife likes blue, so all the buttons should be blue. And that's how the Hippo came to be.
Can I throw one more idea in? Because I know we're getting close to time.
I'm getting close to drunk.
Hey, well, good. Let's throw another idea in then.
Every other big marketing group has a lobby, like beyond the lobby bar, the lobby group. There it is. That's a podcast title.
There you go.
The IAB spends a lot of money in Washington.
That is the raison.
The Web Analytics Association, we spend all our money literally at the lobby bar.
That's our raison
d'etre.
Right?
Nice one, Jim.
So when people look at like our community, they confuse us with people that do dirtbag things with online data. I was reading something about Mr. Sanders and Ms. Clinton, and they have access to this Democratic, you know, member database, and weird things happened, and it immediately starts turning into analytics and analysis. We get painted with some pretty shitty brushes, and analysts tend to be some of the more conservative people about what you should capture and how you should maintain and do things with it. Are we at the point where, and it could be, in your opinion, a name change? It could be you know, everybody who's in the game has to put a few dollars in the hat so we can start to lobby or position ourselves differently than some of these, you know, advertising organizations. You know, is there a big next step for us as a community? Nope. Good answer. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We're done.
Glad we're here. So when the WAA started, it was a considered decision to be inclusive of practitioners, us, consultants, us, and vendors. Now, if you can figure out a lobby platform that would benefit all three of those, you are a better person than I am. So we just said, look, if we're going to be a lobby organization, we need to go to each corporation and ask for $50,000 a year to represent them in Washington, D.C., and have a very clear platform. The IAB, they have a clear platform. They have a purpose. They represent a segment. We don't. We represent an area of inquiry that is inclusive. So from the very get-go, we said, we're not going to do lobbying. It's not who we are.
That's interesting. And I love that you just said that, because that really helps position the DAA as the organization that it is.
Yeah.
But it does make one wonder, in the future, is there a separate organization that will need to come up to, you know, contend for the interests of actual measurement and doing it responsibly and in ways that businesses can use it to do the things to make the customer experience ideal?
I don't see that as really possible, because you're advocating for and against collecting data. So we did have Eric Peterson did come up with and posted the standards of ethics. You know, do you agree to this code of conduct?
Yeah, the code of ethics. Yeah,
I really like that. I signed it, I think, the first week.
Absolutely. I did too.
I never signed it.
I'm telling.
Because I am, well, I just told. Yeah, I don't know why I didn't sign it, because I certainly agree with it.
Michael can neither confirm nor deny that he has a thumb drive of credit card numbers in his pocket right now.
Oh, man.
Exactly.
Yeah, Confirm and nor deny.
I have such a schizophrenic relationship with privacy that I really have trouble discussing all of this stuff, because on the one hand, I do not trust corporations and I do not trust governments at all with my data. On the other hand, I will gladly tattoo a barcode on my forehead if it will get me on the airplane faster.
Yeah, or get me the products I want to my house a
day
earlier.
Or tell me what I need before I need it. You know, be the artificial intelligence we were all led to believe could happen. Where's my flying car?
Yeah, or, you know, Google on your phone predicting what you want to know next, which is totally happening.
Every time I get in my car, Google says how many minutes it will take me to get to the office. I'm not going to the office right now. How can they be so stupid?
They're trying.
God bless them.
Yeah, wait till they start driving your car. You get in your car, you just show up at the office and be like, this is not where I was going, guys.
Self-driving cars cannot happen soon enough.
I'm excited about it. I can't wait till I can just sort of be reading the Devil's Data Dictionary whilst commuting to the office.
I will never need to get my license.
I can
skip that whole phase of adulthood entirely and still buy a car.
I can't wait until I can finish this bottle of Jameson's without fearing for my life.
You get pulled over. Have you been drinking? Hell yes,
yes,
I've been drinking.
And texting. Thank you very much.
But the car's had nothing but 220 volts of...
the good stuff.
The good stuff.
That's right. And yeah, if it's low
octane electricity.
All right, so just because it's time for a break in the rhythm, I'm going to read all of the A's from my book.
And they're
not that many. So the first one, the first entry in the Devil's Data Dictionary, you have already heard, it's algorithm, regularly recurring remarks from a former U.S. vice president who invented the internet. This is followed by analysis, when a calculation requires more than 10 fingers. Analytics, same as analysis, but garnished with red pepper rings, microgreens, and chicory. Analysis paralysis, Thursday. API. API is a gateway drug that leads to pulling more data than rational from systems gathering data faster than sensible for reasons more aspirational than comprehensible with feeling.
I like that one.
Assumption is the part that's always wrong, and the A's finish up with average, obscuring the interesting or valuable through homogenization. In other words, on average, Switzerland is flat.
Now, Zing. You skipped one A, and it is the most appropriate for this entire podcast.
Oh, that Mr. Stern, price of would, brevity.
Would you please define artificial intelligence?
Artificial intelligence was included. You must have already been artificially intelligent, because did I not read that out loud? Artificial intelligence is the fourth cocktail.
I swear, maybe I had the fourth cocktail. I think you went straight from API to assumption.
Now that's an assumption. We'll have to listen to
that. Oh, there you go.
That could be the title of this podcast. Just call it The Fourth Cocktail. Intimate and interactive.
I'm like, hey, guys, I'm keynoting in the morning. Maybe it's time to close out the tab.
And I say, hey, Jim, hey, Tim, I got invited too. I'm going to be speaking after lunch on the last day of the show. How'd you get a keynote?
All right. Well, it's that time of the show where we go around and we reflect on maybe what we've learned or share an observation. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Yeah.
This has been a little, I got to say, this has been a little depressing.
You're welcome.
I feel like we talked about the history that could not help but morph into a discussion of the present, and that then also led to a little bit of the future, and there's a lot of stuff that maybe stops just short of intractable from challenges. Organizational, the data, the complexity of the data, the aspirational beliefs in what automation, you know, can and will do.
Tim, I'd just like you to change the word intractable to job security.
Job security.
That's exactly what I was thinking. Job security is looking up.
I can continue to be marginally above mediocre and still be gainfully employed.
You too are from Lake Wobegon.
Yes. So I think that's kind of I've enjoyed the discussion. I picked up a few kind of historical anecdotes, but I will say one of the last things we covered, why the DAA is unlikely to ever be an effective lobbying organization. I don't think I've heard it put that clearly as to why you don't have common interests represented. By design, the DAA has diverse interests represented, and it would be hard for them to unify. By design. So that's kind of fascinating, but also mildly depressing. So thank you. I'm going to go and shoot myself now. No, not job security. I'm going to not do that because I'm going to remind myself that I have job security.
There you go.
All right. I'm going to do this thing where I jump right in front of you, Jim Kane.
I was having fun until Wilson got all dark and shit.
I know. I did not take that from this conversation. I was delighted. I want to share a brief anecdote about my first eMetrics conference. I will share a couple of details in the hopes that some of our listeners can use some of these tips to themselves come to an eMetrics someday. I went to my boss and I said, there are two conferences I want to attend this year, eMetrics in Santa Barbara and this search conference over here. And my boss looked at me and he's like, I don't know. I don't know if we can do two conferences in a year. And I said, okay, I'll just do the one then, eMetrics Santa Barbara. So I was fortunate enough to attend the last eMetrics in Santa Barbara in 2006. And it was a life-changing experience. And I owe you, Jim Stern, a debt of gratitude for fostering a community so open and friendly and willing to share their knowledge and experience in a context like the Lobby Bar. It has enriched me as a professional for years and years and years. So this
you just brought tears to my eyes.
But it's true. You know, if you think about the work of this industry and the people of this industry, where they have intersected over the years in the most meaningful ways has been in the context of the eMetrics conference. So it's something I'm really, you know, it's something we're always trying to recreate together, right? And so anyway, I'm going on too long, but I'm very glad that you were able to be our guest and join us on the Analytics Power Hour. Even if it's mushy, Jim Kane is, you know, nervous about his feelings. Just let him out, Jim. Just let him out.
I'm a good Irish boy. I packed him into a ball and buried him so deep you'll never find him. But kidding aside, when I started – so 10 years ago when I hadn't started Napkin – I was still selling but starting to do some analysis, and I sat on the standards committee. And so I very clearly now understand why it can't be a lobby organization. That was not a fun club.
No.
That was tough. But separately, when I and Tim and I in particular have talked about imposter syndrome before. When I started getting going, one of the first things I got to do when I started Napkin, and it was me and a bulldog in a living room with a Skype phone. It was a smart dog. But his little paws just couldn't work the Excel, so I had him put down. But that I don't want to tell that story. But you know, Jim let me speak at eMetrics Toronto, and that gave me a lot of confidence. Let me meet some people. It helped make some of that imposter syndrome go away. There certainly wouldn't be this podcast if there wasn't an eMetrics, I'll tell you that. Because this is literally what we're trying to do, so it's pretty cool to have you on the show.
Really appreciate your comments. It's kind of why I do this for a living and will continue to do it, because people end up saying stuff like that. So thank you. Tim, please don't shoot yourself. Jim, please don't shoot your dog.
Well, it has certainly been a pleasure. And of course, if you are listening out there and you want to get in on this conversation, I think you may have noticed one thing as we've talked on this show today. And that is, Jim Stern is a really approachable guy. And so if you ever see him at an eMetrics conference lobby bar, you could probably sit down and have a chat and buy him a drink. And you may be surprised. Some person from Europe, probably named Renee, will come over and give you a chocolate. You never know. And if you're listening and you've got comments, we would love to hear them. You can always reach us on our Facebook page or the Measure Slack, which you can also find from our Facebook page. And of course, we're on Twitter as well. I don't know whose bright idea that was, but apparently we might be running 1% tests on you on that. So just be careful. What a great nostalgic show. My spirits are lifted. Apparently Tim's are like, it has opposite effects.
Zero sum game.
Yeah, there you go. But it's so great to get a chance to sort of peel back the layers and think about where we've come from and how that points us to where we might be going. And, you know, as you're listening, how you can play a part in that. Obviously, there's a couple things that we talked about tonight that probably should be of interest to everyone. The eMetrics conference, certainly worth attending. They have multiple locations in the U.S. and abroad, so definitely look for that near you this year. The Devil's Data Dictionary, I think aptly displayed this show, is noticeable in that it should be a part of every good analyst desk reference. You should have that easy to hand, so definitely go and get a copy of that. And of course, the DAA, which is not a lobbying organization, but is an organization for you, the practitioner, consultant, or vendor. So become a member of that as well. So, Jim Stern, thank you once again for being our guest.
My pleasure.
Had a great time. And as always, for my co-hosts, Tim Wilson and Jim Kane, keep analyzing.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. We welcome your comments and questions. Facebook.com/AnalyticsHour or at Analytics Hour on Twitter.
So smart guys wanted to fit in, so they made up a term called analytics. Analytics don't work.
With your indulgence, I'd like to read a little poem I call Insight. Insight from the Devil's Data Dictionary. It's not having the answer. It's dreaming up the question. It's pivoting like a dancer, then testing with regression. It's not about the facts. It's making the connection. It's that which then attracts you to create a new projection. It's not about the figures. It's about the correlation. And big data just gets bigger with more data integration. It's not the data warehouse. It's the cross-association. It's not the beans that count, but considering causation. It's asking why and asking how and looking for the info that will open doors and disavow hip shooting from the hippo. Big data isn't magic. Big data is not divine. Big data becomes tragic when art is left behind. The human head contains much more than 100 billion neurons. There are thoughts and schemes and stuff that dreams are built of and are built on. Human beings can look at a cloud and see a face resolving and fantasize how that relates to the problem they're solving. Feed your head, the Dormouse said. Don't die from dried up facts. Imagination speeds creation, and for that, you must relax. Let your brain recuperate and give it room to breathe. Let the sweat of your brow evaporate. Stop the grinding of your teeth. Go for a walk. Have a beer. Go swimming in the ocean. Light a fire. Indulge desire. Wallow in emotion. As one grows older, Einstein said, one sees the great futility of imposing your will on the chaos with brute force and hostility. But if you can be patient, there may come that moment when your mind is on vacation. The answer bows and says, here I am.